All right. 132466, Carter versus Butts. And it's Mr. Bayani, yes?
Bayani, yes, correct.
Bayani, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I am Parag Bayani, and I represent the petitioner appellant, Che Carter, in this habeas case. Your Honors, the Strickland case before the Indiana Supreme Court was very straightforward. But for the deficient performance of Ms. Cho, the appellate counsel, in failing to raise the erroneous attempted murder jury instruction as a Spradlin fundamental error claim, was there a reasonable probability of a different outcome in the 1992 direct appeal? That is, was there a reasonable probability of a reversal and a remand for a new trial? The answer to that question is yes. There was more than a reasonable probability. As a matter of fact, the probability approaches 100% certainty. And here's why. For 19 years, Indiana courts had uniformly applied the rule of fundamental error as set out in Beasley v. State and Williams v. State, where there is a reversal and a remand for a new trial unless intent was not at issue in attempted murder, which it was in this case, and unless the instructions taken as a whole cured the deficient error, which they did not in this case. That is, for 19 years up until Carter 5, the ruling of the Indiana Supreme Court is literally unprecedented. Second, for years, Indiana courts have held that jurors are presumed to follow the instructions given to them by the judge and not the arguments of counsel. And it's hard to square what the Indiana Supreme Court did in Carter 5 with the instructions that were given to the jury by the judge in this very case.
Mr. Bayani, would you agree that the Indiana Supreme Court was applying Indiana law in this case, in Mr. Carter's case, in concluding that the jury had been adequately informed of the intent requirement?
Well, Your Honor, two responses to that. First of all, it seems as if they said they were applying Strickland, and so we'll take them at that, but if they were applying state law, then this case was not an unreasonable application of Strickland case. It was contrary to Strickland. It was applying a state law as opposed to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was before it on post-conviction review. And so if that was the case, if it was contrary to Strickland...
hang on a second. Let's suppose that the plaintiff or the petitioner here had argued Spradlin error in direct appeal. Would the issue of harm or prejudice have been part of the analysis in that context?
No, Your Honor. Then it would have been an application of the rule set out in Spradlin, which means it's reversible.
According to some appellate decisions, but here we've got the Indiana Supreme Court saying this jury was adequately informed of the intent requirement.
Correct, Your Honor. That was a break from 19 years of uniformly applying the precedents.
But you can't be arguing the Indiana Supreme Court is wrong about Indiana law.
I'm not arguing that, Your Honor. I'm arguing if it is a question of the Indiana court applying an issue of Indiana law that is precedent, that is inextricably tied up with the federal ineffective assistance of counsel issue, then this court should still grant Mr. Carter relief because, first of all, again, if it's not a Strickland question, then it's contrary to Strickland. Second, if they're deciding that there was no fundamental error as a matter of state law, ergo there was no prejudice, then it might very well be the case that the Indiana Supreme Court's ruling in Carter 5 was self-contradictory, and here's why. They say that there was, as a matter of state law, there was no fundamental error because the arguments of counsel cured the deficient instruction, ergo no prejudice. Basically, that the fundamental error issue that would have been raised would have lost anyway. But earlier in the opinion, they said that it was likely that Ms. Choke performed deficiently in failing to raise the fundamental error issue. And in Indiana courts, if we're talking about ineffective appellate counsel, there's usually not a finding of deficient performance unless the issue that could have been raised but wasn't would have been a winning issue. Meaning that when they say at the bottom of the opinion, the fundamental error claim was a losing issue, ergo no prejudice, but they say at the top of the opinion, she was likely deficient in her performance, it means that she'd likely failed to raise a winning claim. So it seems like it might be self-contradictory. In addition, not only was this a break from 19 years of application of the Spradlin rule as set on in Beasley v. Williams, this was also unprecedented in another way, and that is, as far as we've been able to recognize, the Indiana courts have never changed state substantive law in the ineffective assistance of counsel procedural posture in a post-conviction appellate case. They always decide whether or not there was prejudice based on the law at the time. Furthermore, Your Honor, as an aside, the Carter 5 holding, the operative holding that the arguments of counsel can cure deficient jury instruction for a Spradlin attempted murder, hasn't been cited in 4 years since Carter 5 was published in the summer of 2010. So I would like to go back to why there was Strickland prejudice. So we have Indiana courts saying for years that jurors are presumed to follow instructions, not the arguments of counsel. And it's hard to square with what happened in Carter 5 with what the instructions were in this very case. And I'll read some of those to you right now. First of all, you are also the finders of the law that applies to this case, being guided by the instructions given by the judge. Second, the definitions and material elements of all crimes charged and included will be stated in other instructions. Third, any comments by counsel, including the opening and closing arguments of counsel, should not be considered by you as evidence in this case. And finally, you should return that verdict which you find just and proper under the laws given to you in these instructions.
Counsel, there's no question that this was an odd decision under Indiana law.
Yes.
But it was a decision under Indiana law by the Indiana Supreme Court. And I understood the court's decision to be saying, in essence, we're not going to decide ineffective performance. We're going to go ahead and resolve the issue on prejudice. And we don't see a problem here because the jury was adequately informed. Now, with respect to the Spradlin instruction error, that's purely state law, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
The Spradlin instructions are not required as a matter of the federal
constitution. There's no Supreme Court precedent that says anything about the Spradlin type instruction.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you want to save some time?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Come on up, Mr. Martin. Oh, boy.
May it please the court. The district court correctly denied relief in this case based on petitioner's claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel. It was a fairly straightforward application of the familiar standard for ineffective assistance.
No one is defending the elements instruction that the jury was given. In this case. And notwithstanding what the attorneys may have argued, how can we know that the jury did not follow the instruction rather than the attorney's arguments? I mean, aren't we always presuming that the jury will obey the court's instructions no matter what else happens during the trial? I mean, when I think of how often we would say in the district court, the attorney's arguments are not the law. I will give you the law.
Well, Your Honor, as my opponent just pointed out to the court, things that were said to the jury was told that arguments of counsel weren't evidence. But that notwithstanding, Your Honor, here, I have to take a little issue with the characterization of 19 years of application of fundamental error review to Spradlin claims. The fundamental error review is not pigeonholed into any particular inquiries. Here we have, as Judge Hamilton pointed out, a situation where, had appellate counsel raised this on direct review, it would have been reviewed under precisely the same standard that was applied on post-conviction review that the Indiana Supreme Court found showed that there was no fundamental error. It wasn't preserved at trial, so it was already under the rubric of fundamental error. That's what the Indiana Supreme Court applied on discretionary review here. Now, with respect to the arguments of counsel, here, Throughout its brief, the appellant alludes to the fact that cases had pointed to the circumstances of other portions of the instructions adequately apprising the jury of its need to find the specific intent and whether the specific intent was a central issue in the case. And the Indiana Supreme Court pointed to both of those things in finding that there was no fundamental error here because, as the court is aware, now, while this instruction, Your Honor, does not comply with all of the technical requirements of Spradlin, it did instruct the jury that they had to find that the defendant took a substantial step toward a knowing and intentional killing. And I guess getting back to that 19 years of jurisprudence, when appellant challenges the court's reliance in any way on the rather detailed and correct statements of law that were given by both the parties regarding what they had to find, the jury that is, with respect to specific intent, they had to go all the way to the Fifth Circuit to a case from 1993 on habeas review. And in that case, the instruction that was found to have been error on trial counsel's part, not appellate counsel, but trial counsel in the first instance, not to challenge it, repeatedly told the jury that they could choose whether they found that the defendant had the specific intent to kill or the specific intent to cause grave bodily injury. And repeatedly said that, giving that jury that choice on multiple occasions. Whereas here, the poison pill that the Spradlin jurisprudence has kind of made something that you have to steer away from in an elements instruction is using the word knowingly in any portion of the instruction. And that was true here, and so that was the error. Now, if they had asked for that instruction, you know, giving a specific intent instruction to the jury and the trial court had refused it, or if they objected to the instruction given and preserved it, then it would have been a meritorious claim on appeal. But that didn't happen. So the question then becomes, was this a fair trial or was it not? The Indiana Supreme Court applied its jurisprudence, reviewing that for fundamental error like it does in every case. The Indiana law is quite evident that any time a jury instruction is challenged as fundamental error, the evidence, the instruction itself, the language of other instructions, and arguments of counsel are considered to determine whether it's fundamental error. There's no reason why that would be any different in a Spradlin case. It's just that usually in a Spradlin case they have pointed to whether the intent was centrally at issue and what the language of the other instructions was. At any rate, again, there's no federal component to the law that the Indiana court applied to determine whether counsel was ineffective or not. It was a waived claim, so they were applying their fundamental review, and I think it was a fairly easy call that this wouldn't have created a reasonable probability of success on appeal. And so it was a straightforward application of Strickland. The district court correctly denied relief. Does the court have further questions of the state? We would ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Thank you. All right. You've got some time left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Let's see how much time.
3 minutes.
A couple of points of rebuttal, Your Honor. First of all, again, I want to reiterate that we've not been able to find over 19 years 59 cases applying uniformly the Spradlin typology set on Williams. We haven't been able to find one case that diverges from it. Moreover, we have the case of Grundy v. State, a 1998 Court of Appeals opinion, which had a materially identical jury instruction, and they found fundamental error, and they reversed and remanded it for a new trial. In addition, if there is not a federal component to this case, which it's possible that the state said in its argument just now, then that means it's not a Strickland case, and I want to make it clear that there are two potential readings of Carter 5. We have a decision about Strickland. Was there a reasonable probability of a different outcome on appeal? We believe that was an unreasonable determination. Or it was a question of state law. You know, when they talk about fundamental error, it's a question of state law, in which case they weren't applying Strickland at all. They're applying state law, and therefore it's contrary to.
When the argument is made that counsel has failed to raise a meritorious state law issue, then the Strickland analysis and the state law issue blend together, right?
It's possible, Your Honor.
You can't evaluate prejudice under Strickland without evaluating the prospects for success under state law. They go together. I think that's clear in Shaw against Wilson. It's clear in other cases of this type. And the thing that's so unusual about this case is that the Indiana Supreme Court has said in this case, in essence, as a matter of state law, we think this jury was sufficiently informed, but it's all state law.
Your Honor, if this is a question of state law that's inextricably bound up with the federal issue, as antecedent to a federal issue, depending on how you phrase it. And I want to reiterate that, first of all, it seems like Carter 5 was self-contradictory in terms of how it determined the state law applied to each performance of Strickland. I would also analogize this case. I would call it a parallel to the doctrine of an adequate and independent state law ground being sufficient to bar a federal court reviewing a federal claim. Now, generally, in the adequate state ground situation, you talk about state procedural rules, which are deemed adequate if they're not arbitrary or unforeseen as a way of blocking federal court review of a federal claim. I mean, in this case, what we have is a state substantive rule, not a procedural, but a substantive rule, which is applied arbitrarily in an unforeseen way, a total break from 19 years of the Spradlin jurisprudence, in a way that blocks this court from reviewing a federal claim. It sort of embodies the hypothetical worry that was posed Judge Eastbrook's dissenting opinion in Cole v. Young from 1987, which says that the state court cooked up a state ground to avoid a legitimate federal claim, a federal claim independent of the argument that a state court erred in construing the substantive law.
Cite on that?
Excuse me?
Do you have a citation on that?
I don't. It's Cole v. Young from 1987. I can provide a 28-J letter with the...
Cole against Young?
Yes.
Thank you.
And,
that's good enough.
I'm out of time. I just want to say that this court should grant Mr. Carter relief in the form of a writ condition on a new trial for attempted murder, not a new appeal, and that the trial should be able to take place within a set amount of time after this court's decision. Thank you.
Okay. Now, were you appointed?
We were...
No, you're not.
No.
We were not appointed.
And where are you in law school?
I just finished at Indiana University.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you for...
Thank you.
...doing this today and doing such a fine job.
Thank you.
And thank you, State of Indiana, for doing such a fine job. All right. Case will be taken under advisement.